So you're thinking about starting a new website, huh? Maybe you have a new small business idea and want to sell something online. Not porn. I tried that. Went out of business. Turns out there's a lot of competition online for porn. Who knew? Maybe you want to show off your photography, or maybe you want to start that new podcast. GoDaddy is offering an amazing deal. One new or transfer.com for just $1.99 for the first year. That's right, $1.99 for the entire year. You know what you get for $1.99? You get like a 199 pieces of penny candy. They don't exist anymore, but you could get it if you had $1.99. You get my point. Anyway, each new .com comes with a free instant page website and built-in photo album. So what are you waiting for? Get your website started today. Go to GoDaddy.com and enter code Paul at checkout or click on the GoDaddy banner on our website.
Warriors, come out to play.
One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. This week, very excited to welcome my friend Rick Overton, brilliant comedian. Rick started doing stand-up when he was just a teenager, if you can believe it, in New York City, where he grew up and cut his teeth at the famous Improv Comedy Club and worked with the likes of Robin Williams and Richard Pryor, and just a real pillar of the comedy community, like a pure artist. A brilliant social satirist, political satirist, and somebody that everybody in the comedy community looks up to, both as peers and people who have come after him. He's got a really great podcast that I did a few weeks ago called The Overview, and it's on the Sideshow Network. You should definitely check that out, and you should check Rick out Monday night, August 26th, the night this episode is premiering, at the Improv Olympics in Los Angeles at 8 o'clock. He's doing a show called News Skim, a really cool improv show that ties into the news. And if you want to check me out doing stand-up, I'm going to be in New York City this week at all the clubs: Caroline's, the Comedy Cellar, the Comic Strip, Stand Up New York, and the Stand. For showtimes, go to my website, paulmercurio.com, on Facebook, Paul Mercurio, or follow me on Twitter, at Paul Mercurio. All right, thanks for tuning in.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Very excited this week to welcome to the podcast my friend, great comedian, great comedic actor, Rick Overton. Rick is an Emmy Award winner from the Dennis Miller Live Show, is a writer on that show, and has an amazing list of credits, has been in, played characters in The Office. He's recently been on Leverage. He's been on the movie Groundhog Day, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Mrs. Doubtfire, The Weird Al Show, which I want to ask you about. Welcome to the podcast, buddy.
Hey, Paul, thanks, man. It's a real pleasure to be here. I do appreciate you having me on. I'm a big fan.
Oh, absolutely. So I want to get into a little bit about your background and stuff, but like, what was it like working on The Weird Al Show? And what tell people what that show was. Weird Al Yankovic, right?
That's fun. He's he had a really funny kid, smart kid show, which you don't see as much anymore these days, do you?
Yeah.
It was
yeah,
a good exactly. one. He had a great show. But he played, I was with Brian Haley, and we were two different, like, Superman. He was like Speed Demon, and I was Slow Molasses Man. And I had this outfit that I had to walk in slow motion, and a steamroller just rolls right over me and kills me. And, you know, so there's like some actually pretty wild humor for a kid's show, but leave it to Weird Al to do. Well,
yeah, that's amazing.
We just did a podcast on Overview, my podcast, with Al.
So oh, you did, up yeah.
He's always doing something new, which I love, nonstop. He's a nonstop artist. Great.
Well, Rick has a great podcast himself called Overview on the Sideshow Network, which I've been on, and it's just and I, we were had a good time on the jump.
I was going to thank you for that again. Yeah, thanks, man. It was a great podcast.
So, Rick, you come from like a really interesting background that a lot of people may not be aware of. I mean, they obviously know your comedy, and you started, you know, back in New York City, like in the 70s at the Improv in New York, but like your parents are really established musical people, your dad and your mom both, your dad, a teacher, a music arranger for Thelonious Monk, and your mom, a singer on two great songs. With the tell people about your parents' background a little bit. It's really fascinating.
My mom was one of the Cordettes, Lollipop,
yeah.
Mistress, and she wasn't in the original recordings of some of the numbers, but one of the gals got pregnant, so she took over and did the road stuff and did some recording later. And it just ran for a while before she already had me, but then she had my brother Steve, and then that was just too much, and she stayed home. So my dad was a teacher at Juilliard, and he used his GI Bill to work on becoming a really experienced and accomplished jazz musician and composer, and he wound up teaching at Juilliard and the New School, and he was Thelonious Monk's big band arranger on the Monk at Town Hall album. That's my dad's arrangement, Hall Overton.
Wow. Was that a big, I know you play the harmonic. Was that a big influence on you? And you think that's a reason sort of you kind of veered toward the arts? I mean, obviously
totally. No doubt.
Yeah.
That played a huge lucky break, and it's a lucky break. You know, I know that.
Yeah.
To be able to have the opportunity to be around artists when I'm little and still, you know, in that being formatted phase of my life.
Yeah.
It's when that's being loaded along with language skills, I think that helped. That was a lucky break that way. And there's an up and a downside to it, of course, but I like the upside a lot.
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels between music and comedy. It's very lyrical. It can be improvisational like music can be. It can, you know, take over a room emotionally the way music can. And I think there are a lot of parallels. And I imagine that, you know, just being around that environment sort of was kind of made you so unique in your comedy, because it just gave you a different window into things.
Yeah. I think seeing adults act a little differently gives you a different kind of permission. You've seen examples of it in your life. And so now you can picture yourself not just doing something you were told to do, and try to figure out how to make what you want to do somehow monetize itself for your life down the road.
Right. Well,
using,
it's funny.
How can I make the right half of my head cobble one of those?
Right. And would you hang out when you were a little kid with your mom or your dad, or when they were working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. They'd take me around. So I would see comedians opening for musicians and, you know, that kind of stuck in my head. And my dad was crazy about Jonathan Winters. Crazy about. Dinner would stop. Everything stopped if he's on TV or something.
Oh, God. And you got to be on Paul Provenza's show, The Green Room, with Jonathan Winters. What was that like? Because I never met him, and I'm a huge fan and was a huge fan. It's too bad he passed away. But, like, what was he? I know he could be kind of morose and up and down in his moods and stuff. And what was that like?
Well, you know, we got to be pals, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's sad. His wife was gone. His best friend. So that's, you know, it's not like morose for nothing.
Yeah. No.
He was gone. You know, he's blue, and but you know what cheered him up was a couple of guys come over, start messing around, and you know, let him have an audience to play bits, do a little bit back, know your place, don't overdo it. It's his thing, you know. It was perfect. Just sit back and absorb. If you see on The Green Room, I'm not talking much because I'm in awe, and my jaw is dropping because. Is Jonathan to one side, one huge influence, another gargantuan influence. Robert Klein sitting over there. We're still, you know, we're friends today. And
yeah.
It's cool when you get to have someone who's a hero and a friend all in one.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Every now and then, if you're lucky, and I'm not saying I'm not lucky, I'm totally lucky. That's just dumb luck that happened to me. And I'm owning it, and I'm not saying no. It's great.
No, it's
great
more
to meet people
more
you admired.
Yeah, but it's more than luck. I mean, it's like, you know, those people wouldn't let you into their life if you weren't talented in your own right. And did Jonathan ever, like, sort of impart any wisdom on you, or did, just in observing him, was there anything you took away as a performer, a comedian, as a writer that, like, informs kind of what you do now, or changed the way you looked at things as a comedian? Or any comedian, for that matter, that has had some influence on you. I know you mentioned in some interviews I read, you know, Richard Pryor had a big influence on you, and you know, those
George Carlin.
And George Carlin.
Like, I'd say that between the two of them, it's like there's a big 10K lamp on a stand. Mm-hmm. And it pivots on the side wheels there. And you can spin it around so you face it outward. And that's mm-hmm. what Carlin did. He'd aim the 10K out, look at this over there, and look at that over there. He didn't talk, and then, but the Richard spun it around and just bombed himself in the face, in the soul with it.
Yeah.
And just hit himself at point-blank range with a 10K.
Yeah.
And with that, you know, it's like surgically honest about it.
And you sort of... you know, you kind of cut your teeth in New York, right? At the Improv in New York, where Silver Friedman, Bud Friedman owned on 44th Street. Is that the club?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So you were hanging out with these guys as a young comic and seeing them coming up. And, like, what do you remember, like, your first influences, like, in that environment and sort of the impact that these guys, did you say, oh, my God, I'm watching these guys, and how are they doing this, and can I do this? Or what was going through your head at the time?
I was in a team. Two-man team, Overton and Sullivan. And, you know, we mostly just did set stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Stick to the script.
Yeah.
But we would also, we liked improv. And people who were doing improv, they looked like they were having more fun than us.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, because they were. And, so we tried to go learn a little improv, but in that process, it created things that sort of started breaking the team up. As you discover the other parts of yourself, sometimes it isn't about a partner anymore, or you start really having creative disagreements. And when you're a team working for nothing, it's all pure art. Everything's about the art. Nothing's more important.
Yeah.
As soon as you start getting paid, it all becomes about whose premise was more important than whose punchline.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whose
car?
That's
what I always...
Yeah, but I pay for all the gas, you know.
You didn't pick up the check. That's why I think bands have it a lot harder, musicians have it harder than comedians, because you've got to coexist with a group of, you know, usually messed up, dysfunctional people, and just people in general can be dysfunctional, no matter whether they're a musician or not. Like, you know, a comedian is a one-man band, and you only have your own demons to answer to. So it's like, on some level, it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
And
I think, you know, once you do get it figured, I was scary at first. At mm-hmm. first, yeah, I was scared. But then after I started getting a roll of a few laughs, it started to ease off. But I had an impulse to look left a lot.
Because that's where your partner was. That's hilarious.
Yeah, a big blank space where the partner was, you know. And but I could see my body doing trigger things like that. It's really funny when I look at it now.
Was Pryor working at that time at the Improv? Would he come in? Was Carlin coming by at that time, or were they sort of beyond that point and, you know, just sort of working bigger venues, and did they have an influence at that stage of your career?
Yeah, they were getting a little bigger by the time I got in. And so they would show up on occasion. Rodney showed up all the time. Man, you got get ready to be bumped by Rodney.
Really?
Yeah, Andy was showing up a lot. He was still hanging out a lot. You know, I don't know. I've done this in a couple of interviews, right? I've told this story, but here's the deal about Andy Kaufman. I'm the first guy Tony Clifton ever dunked a pitcher on the head of.
Seriously? Oh, really?
He just pulled me out as a prototype to test it and put me in the audience to see if this worked. He had no makeup. It's just Andy in a T-shirt. No makeup. No... Tony Clifton, nothing. It was just him. That's what we had to call him, Tony Clifton. So he's just figuring out what this would do, because he loved pissing everybody off. the audience, the crowd, everybody, he loved messing with you and then winning it back. And so he would he'd make me sit in the front of the crowd all night long through the entire show of everybody that can't make eye contact with me like they know me. And they all got to treat me like I'm just some audience guy, just so he can come out of Stony Clifton and go, hey, you think that's funny? Here's a real joke. Come up on stage, splash. And he hits me with the pitcher, and I got to walk off pissed.
Oh, my God.
And so he can make the guy go, boo, and then he wins him back. Or sometimes he didn't win him back. But it's
how would he get him back? I mean, I've never seen, would he start to apologize? How did that play out?
Yeah, at some point you got to realize it's Andy Kaufman, you know, and he's messing with you, and it's the sort of, you know, for a moment you feel that, and then you have to clear your head and go, okay, he's still just messing with me, but had to have been planted or whatever. But they'd sort of come around. Most of the time they'd come around. It's amazing. Yeah. He had the same kind of Jedi mind control that Sasha Cohen has. Some guys have it, and they can just, Phil Hendry has it, they can just punk you forever, and as soon as you're wising up, they change the subject, and you're right back on the hook again.
You know who's like that? I don't know if you knew him, A. Whitney Brown, who was he was on SNL.
Oh yeah, I know A. Whitney.
And he was on The Daily Show early on, which I was on, and still am, but with him, and a really bright guy, but he just, in a very subtle, very kind of Jedi mind, that like would just like to mess with you just to see if he can mess. And not just the subjects of his interview. He had this one classic style, you know, like every interviewer in real news has like their little go-to question or their hook that they go to. So Whitney developed one on The Daily Show as a correspondent, and he'd be interviewing somebody like, I don't know, the mayor of some, I don't know, pick a city, Atlanta, whatever, and the guy's got some harebrained scheme, and he'll say to the guy, so you've got this idea to, you know, do so-and-so with all the streetlights. Yes, that's correct. Now, some people would say that that's inventive, maybe a bit odd, strange, bizarre, completely off your rocker, you're a douchebag. Like he's just, and the guy would just keep nodding because it was such a mind fuck, and you'd watch this guy, and then he'd catch himself like, wait a minute, I just agreed that I'm an asshole. Like, it was the most unbelievable.
It shows a listening skills test, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then he'd do that in the office with you. He would do that with you in the office, too. He'd just start messing with you. You realize, hey, wait a minute. Like, you're three, because he's so affable, and he's got that sort of Midwestern likability, just real easy to take, that you don't know that you're being fleeced. It was brilliant, you know.
he like Harry Anderson were very enamored by the eloquent traveling con man, you know. Sort of all, not so much the sleazy kind, but almost the music man kind. Eloquent and oratory.
So when you
the Barker, the snake oil salesman.
Yeah, that's exactly the vibe Whitney gives off. Like, you know, and it's funny, Harry, you know, would I even dress like that with that sort of fedora and the watch chain and all of that stuff? And Whitney was brilliant at it, and you know, was very dry and did stand up, but he was very, very dry, you know, and I'm curious though, like when you were in a team, then you go out on your own, that's a big leap. You mentioned you're looking to your left a lot, but like creatively at that point, did you have a sense of the kind of things you wanted to talk about? And I'd imagine that you probably were talking about things then that you wouldn't talk about now. Like, were you focusing more, was it autobiographical? Because you're a great observational comic about politics and social and societal issues. Now, were you doing that then, or was that something that evolved later?
Well, I had silly stuff too, and there was, you know, a sprinkling of it here and there, and certainly, you know, when I started coming out of the Carter era, kind of, you know. I really started doing it for myself out of the Nixon era, my first team in high school. And
Really? That far back, huh?
Oh, it's my 40-somethingth year of doing it, yeah.
Wow. And and did you kind of, for a young kid to be sort of politically oriented like that and talking about that in stand-up, like, how did audiences kind of not quite know how to handle that yet, or what was the vibe like?
The audiences were coming out of the Watergate time where SNL was more political. You could do it, you know. As long as you hit the basics, you could do it.
Yeah.
Everyone was against the Vietnam War, and right. you didn't get a lot. By the end, you didn't get a lot of pro-war sentiment anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We were starting to enter an era where everyone, if they weren't going liberal, they were really going to be the loosened up version of what they were. And I think, you know, it's like the one of the second, third phase of the end echo of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone, I think, sort of back, as the Vietnam War ended, sort of crisis averted and people loosened up. And the whole point of discoism is to go from the hippie experience of, we're here to help everyone in a collective. The disco experience is, I'm just going to focus on how I feel.
Right.
And
right.
Going
right.
For me first hedonism, right? So,
right. Right.
And that, we've never completely come out of that.
Oh, no, I don't think we have. And you know, you mentioned that continuing from the 70s into the 80s, and you've mentioned in the past that, you know, sort of mean comedy kind of seemed to be the sort of the tone of the day then, but I think you feel like that just doesn't play now, because in the 80s it was sort of go, 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 and people were making money hand over fist, and there weren't a lot of tragedies in that time, and it's harder to be mean when we live in a more tragic time. I mean, I was fascinated by that.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear you expand on that a little bit.
Well, I think the luxury of living in an era of no war, because you look at it now, do you remember the last time we weren't? It's a while ago, isn't it, buddy?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in for a kind of a retooling to get back to any place that we remember when we backed off at one time. And at one time, we were backing off. Life got easier. And when it gets easier, you have your crisis mode shuts off, and it stops problem sourcing at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll always see art respond as an answer to a crisis of some sort. It seems like it speaks at first. Songs will change, the lyrics will change, certain movie plots will change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that certainly the people making the product want to sell it to the people who feel their zeitgeist has been addressed, you know. I just think comedians have gotten, some hung on to politics the entire time, and they're truly, truly to be admired, Dick Gregory and George and all those guys. And I think when Reagan came in, I sort of reactivated in the early 80s. I started to fire it back up again.
But what was it about that time that made you feel like, well, I need to sort of, because I guess you were doing it, you got away from it, and then you went back to it, from what you're saying, in the 80s with Reagan. Like, what was it about you, because you felt there was sort of there wasn't a voice.
It wasn't all a good change.
Mm.
Right. It was like, if you're a rocker, it's like watching disco come in.
Right. And you're like, is this going to be our lives, the rest of our lives? Is this?
Yeah,
is it
all going to be this? Yeah, is this me to thump stupid shit all night? What happened to good music that isn't all just done by a box, you know?
Yeah. Well, that must have been a great outlet for you then to work on Dennis Miller Live. And you worked with some great people.
Oh, it was
Feldman,
great.
Tom Hertz, a friend of mine. Love Feldman.
Yeah.
He's Was that a learning curve for you? I mean, I know me writing on The Daily Show certainly
absolutely
was. And, you know, you write for yourself and you write politically like we do and whatever, and you think, I got this. But then you get on a show and you're writing for somebody else's voice. And what was that adjustment like for you, and what was the hardest part of that transition working on a show like that?
Working on Dennis Miller Live on HBO was a challenge to your ability to roar through three newspapers at the speed of light. And pick out a few stories, start seeing what looks like a general consensus, this is a good one to hit this week, go back, start knocking out material on it. You got to do your monologue first, which is you hit all the headlines, and you have to, you know, try and come up with as many jokes about the main people in these headlines that everybody will recognize and know. And then you do the photos, the rant and the photos are the other two big things, where you have a stack of several hundred photos a week that you do captions for.
Right.
And it builds the muscle that does that quickly. And the rant, and everyone, you know, picks a topic for a rant and goes off on it. And if Dennis likes it, you go further and you redo it. And but he's in the main room, and there's a projector with a laptop, with someone scrolling, and the part you wrote, if it's not what he's looking for, he just goes, nope, blank, gone. And you watch hours of you working on that thing just go blank and gone, and then you look back later and go, what's he going to do? You can't make it a 9-hour show every week, you know. You just wish it was your monologue all the time or your bit. But there's a room full of brilliant people, and it gets in enough that you see it's just a big round robin. You got to pull your ego way out of this one, pal, if you want to stay in this game. It's too many other people who are just wonderful. Just be happy and lucky you're with wonderful people.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm grateful for. I got a lot of stuff in. It's amazing. You know, it's great.
I always likened it to, you know, we had a deadline. We usually had like 3 hours in the morning to get the jokes in to first round of, review by John, the head writer, executive producer. And I always likened it to, it's like taking a final every morning, you know, because once you get those topics, you're just sitting there trying to crank as many jokes as you can, great jokes. And it's why people sometimes say, why do I have so many writers on a show? Because on any given day, somebody's going to be a little off, somebody's going to be more on.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You need to sort of balance that, sort of those odds out, you know? And then, you know, we'd have those things where you just think, oh, this is the perfect joke, and then it gets changed in rehearsal or it gets cut, and you're like, you want to put your head or somebody's head, right? You know that feeling, right?
I know it all too well.
Did you ever like lobby for your jokes or Yeah.
You sit in a big round robin table and everyone starts talking at once, you know, and you know, they all hold a hand up and they do their thing. Well, what do you got on Clinton? What do you got on Clinton?
Right.
And around we go, you know, and a lot of times you'll hear your own damn joke because that's the joke.
Yeah. There's been that time where someone got to the joke before you. Literally, it was like someone read the packet, and they read somebody else's joke, and it was the exact same joke. So by the time oh my God, it's the worst feeling in the world.
Right? And especially since we're a Friday show, so you know what that means. That means we have to review everything that Jay or David or Kilborn did then, or Jon Stewart later did, or any of the late night people that were also getting all the topics from Monday through Thursday.
So
that wiped out divisions of, if sometimes the joke's the joke, and those, they just got it first.
Yeah.
It really trains you to find that last angle on it.
Yeah, and sort of, while even though you're writing for somebody else's voice, it does hone your voice, you know what I mean? And it does hone your ability to sort of execute things quickly. And any great stories in terms of, like, you know, just you know, you don't have to mention names, but just coming to blows over something, or, you know, fighting for something, winning the battle or losing the battle, or anything with guests, or, you know, there's always fun war stories from working on shows. I don't know if there are any on your end, but it was a great show. It was a great, great show.
Countless.
Countless war stories, huh?
Countless war stories.
Yeah. Tom Hertz is a good guy. Tom's the EP and creator of Rules of Engagement, and I remember working with him in New York, and he was always very subtle with his comedy, very, very funny. And do you still see him and talk with him?
Not enough, I have to say. I wish.
Yeah, he's a great guy. So did you find that coming out of that show that sort of kept you on that road of political, societal, observational comedy more so than anything else? Did you want to sort of veer away from that? Because you've been, you know, you've always been pretty tried and true to that, you know, for a long time. Did that sort of embolden you, or did it sort of want you to kind of try a different direction coming off of Dennis's show?
Well, it was a job where I got to do something that I already kind of did, but just I have to give the words to Dennis instead of me doing them. And it's like, well, and at times I think, well, at least he's on TV saying them. Someone's saying it. Someone is going to get the lots of ears and eyes at once.
Right.
So, and then, you know, it's a conflicted feeling. Every now and then you kind of wish it was you too, but there's a pride in hearing your joke do well. And if you can wrap your head around the idea that now you're a writer, you do trade one sensation for the other, but pride finds its way, believe me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know, yeah, especially when you're a comedian. I know that feeling. It's definitely there. I mean, do you find that you've done an amazing amount of acting, and you're a really good actor, and a lot of comics can't make that transition, and I think, you know, some do it successfully, some don't, and I think the ones that do, you know, the training as a comic really is to kind of bifurcate your mind and be listening to the audience and seeing how you're sort of self-assessing the set and what's going on and saying, okay, maybe I got to change up here because this chunk of material is not working very well, or somebody drops a glass, or somebody yells something out and you got to deal with it. Whereas an actor has to be trained to be so in the moment and connected with that other person in the relationship, and they can't be stepping outside of themselves and assessing what they're doing. And I think that that's makes the difference between someone who can act and who's a comedian and someone who's a comedian who cannot act, is that ability to turn off that comedian's brain. Do you find that?
I find vice versa to be true as well. I also think that an actor trying to be a comic gets too overly dramatic with certain things and doesn't just settle back and talk to us. And the more acting training I have, the more I am doing a presentation for you.
Right.
And the less I don't picture having dinner with that person, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's not like a real person. But like Louis now is so good. Louis C.K. he's just being himself. He's like so unbelievably just himself. But he's very, very believably himself is what I mean to say.
Well, it takes a long time to get there, and that's why I think sometimes this business can be too quick to judge and cast people aside and, you know, sort of focus, you know, on, oh, you know. I mean, you said something which was, you know, really interesting to me and really resonated with me is, you know, that you didn't necessarily have the best business acumen, but if you make Critical Massacre, that, you know, and stick with something you love, then something significant will happen. And I think that's really eloquent. And expand on that a little bit. I'd love to hear about that a little bit more, because I think it's a really succinct way of putting it.
Well, if your reality is that no matter what, you're kind of this kind of person, I think the best you can do is not fight it like driving a rental car with the emergency brake on the whole time. Don't go to war with your, the way forward really drives forward for you. Invent somehow to make that work. The happiest people in the world are the ones that don't have that burning brake smell the whole time.
Yeah.
Because they're driving in the correct direction for themselves. They may not have the nicest car, but if you have a really expensive car and you still have that brake smell, what's that doing, you know?
Well, but you're a human being. I'm a human being. Haven't you ever, you know, in your career started to see, I mean, you could see this at times with certain comics that were hitting big, and then you'd start to see a rash of newer comics all kind of emulating that style of comedy, which I don't think is a healthy thing, because I think each comic has their own individual voice or has to try to find it. But did you ever find yourself looking over your shoulder, looking to the left already, going, oh, that seems to be the hot thing. Maybe I should try to do more of that. Like, have you ever put yourself in that position mentally?
I probably should have.
No, no, you would. We would.
Now
we wouldn't have Rick over.
Me. Where were you years ago? No. you know, I kind of just follow what I notice and my impulses when I'm doing my act. And I've had an act that has some road stuff in it, and I can always pull that out. Mm-hmm. But right now, I guess, you know, at my age, I'm just starting to just really do what I like. I want to do the act that would make me laugh if I saw someone else do it.
And how would you describe that act today as opposed to what it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
Yeah. Less political in the sense of one side or the other. I'm talking more about what looks to be raw elemental human traits.
Yeah.
What's the glitch in our brain? The fact that we're, you know, the fact that we're always on the iPhone because it's lit, and like a bug, we're drawn to the light. And we worship light because of sun worship, and anything that's lit will start accidentally worshiping. And a lot of con men have cashed in on that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing that's great about your comedy is it's deep, but it's still accessible, you know, and you'll come up with these observations where you go, oh, yeah, he's exactly right. I do sort of, I have this phone attached to my hip and I'm constantly checking it. It's a nervous tick. It settles you down if you have social anxiety, because you're allowed to pull yourself out of a conversation or a social situation because, oh, I got to check my phone. And, you know, I think it's hurting society. I don't think it's helping. Also, people don't want to talk on the phone anymore. I had somebody in my business who works with us, I call, and I find it with, like, people just out of college, especially, because they're all trained to just basically function through texting and email, right? And I like talking on the phone. And I call, leave a voice message, and the person emails me back, so we're ready for my desk. I got your message. What did you want to talk about? And I'm like, I want to talk to you about something on the phone. Well, can we talk about it in an email? And I write back, no, that's why I called you. And I had to do 4 emails to get the person to get on the phone with me. It's like, this is kind of where we are.
Oh, you sent that to my spam email. I don't use that one anymore. I do. That's the one I always give when I'm donating to something or I'm voting on something, you know, or a petition. That's my spam, fuck it, who cares email. Yeah. Oh, man, right. I'm sorry. I just didn't check.
Did you ever play music in a band or, like, think about that as a full-time career instead of comedy?
Not instead of comedy, but it's fun.
What was it when you were so young that sparked you with comedy? Was it seeing these opening acts with your dad and your mom and all of that? Or was it just what? For me, it was watching The Tonight Show and seeing these comedians. And I didn't have an idea that I was going to do that then, but I remember just being drawn to that particular performance art. What was it for you? Was it a particular night, a particular show, or just what sparked all of that?
Well, all the Sullivan spots and, you know, and the Johnny Carson shots or the Merv Griffins or the whatevers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing my dad in tears and looking at his face and just thinking, I gotta learn how to make that happen.
Mm.
Get dad to laugh like that. And he was, listen, I'll be straight up with you. I think he was coaching me into it subconsciously. He kept hauling out the Bob Newhart and the Jonathan Winters records, and he'd play them for me. And he took me up in the attic, and he was kind of like a frustrated comic himself in the jazz world. He's the guy that, you know, doesn't matter what you got, you want something else. He looked like a cross between Ben Affleck and JFK. He's like a cool jazz musician. He had everything going for him, but he still wanted to get the laugh.
Yeah.
And so old bald Rick, that now is, you know, roughly 7 years older than he ever got to be, is still going for the laugh that he formatted into me.
Yeah, just, that's amazing that your father would be. Yeah, well, I mean, and that he'd be that hip to most parents are, you know, grooming their kids to be ad execs or lawyers or doctors or whatever. That's pretty cool that he was able to sort of spark that in you and encourage that in you. And what do you think, you know, you and I have talked, we've been on panels together and we've talked about, you know, in kind of in some ways, you know, sort of have been swimming in the same waters in terms of politics and comedy and this and that. I mean, what kind of role do you think comedy plays in, like, national world events? I mean, and where do you think kind of we're headed globally and sort of in terms of where comedy fits into all of that?
I think that comedy has played a huge role in shifting and shaping politics and world perspective, and certainly national perspective. We were running a much closer race until Tina Fey did an impression on SNL of Sarah Palin. It kind of shifted things around. When millions of people see a thing, ridicule is like the shrinking ray, and it can actually, it can shift things, make you just a little bit embarrassed to treat something seriously that's been ridiculed so much. You feel like you're not part of the joke anymore, and no one wants to feel left out.
Do you really think it shapes it? You think it? I mean, I know SNL.
I think it does. I know that the rally for sanity shifted things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some crazy reactionary people on the right who are also, they're going so crazy, they're making their own opposition. Like, they're not bigger than physics, regardless of their denial of science. They're actually not bigger than physics, and physics is you can't keep doing so much evil stuff without someone, you know, countering it with good. And the internet has helped immensely with that.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, it's funny because I'm on the fence about this for this reason. I think that, you know, this advent of, you know, there were four networks, and then there were six, and there wasn't really this cable news world that we live in now. And I feel like, in theory, on paper, it was supposed to make the discourse better, right? It was supposed to really give a voice to more people on both sides, and really. And I found it to be more divisive than informative. And I find, you know, realistically, there's a fresh news cycle every 8 to 10 hours, maybe. I mean, you know, generally during the course of the day, you're going to hear the same three or four stories repeated over and over again. And
cable, definitely. Yeah, cable, once you get advertisers in there, it's like you just can't leave the picnic blanket out that long on the grass.
Mm-hmm.
Here come the buck. And with the advertisers comes enormous, they're buying influence.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how it works. You know, if you want to keep the lights on here, you got to slowly stop talking about certain things that hurt our sales.
Yeah.
But it's newsworthy. Yeah, but we don't care. We try to sell things. We're now modifying news. And because of the, you know, the No More Fairness Act, we can completely dominate because we got more money. And that's what they do.
Right. Well, that's why I think comedy is going to continue to be important, because it really is the last bastion of unedited speech, right? I mean, it's pretty pure in that.
That's,
you know, the club, ain't, you and I both know, those club owners ain't going to kick us out if, no matter, you know, short of Nazi speech, we can say whatever we want to say as long as the asses are in the seats and they're drinking those drinks. And there's something crass commercially about it in terms of capitalism, but also something pure about it that I'm proud to be a part of, and you should too, because, you know, even with the, you know, the Huffington Post of the world, which is supposed to be all about, you know, just everybody has a voice. I know people that work there, and, you know, they're getting squeezed from the people up top, and do this and drive sales, and we want more clicks on our site and do less of this and more of that. And there's just not a lot of places left. And,
yeah,
you know, that's the beauty of stand-up, I think.
With rare exception, stand-up is like maybe the only thing that gets away with doing what the jester did, which is bang on everybody in the room and not get your head chopped off for it.
Right.
And there's people who are scared to death of Jon Stewart. Like, remember when Kramer went on? Jim Kramer from... remember when
here's what happened there.
Money, and he was scared, blanched like a ghost. Please, man, don't say the things that you just said about Tucker Carlson about me.
Right. And also, you know, a lot of these guys underestimate comedians. They just think we're dumb cluck kids who, you know, smoke a lot of weed and watch porn, which we do. Don't pay attention to anything and play down to us. And I know that I think that was part of why Kramer hung himself on our show. Was like, he was very pedantic and like, oh, you guys don't really, you just do your little jokes and you don't really know anything. And it's like, no, we actually have thoughts and pretty good degrees from pretty good universities. And some of us are lawyers. And so you can kiss my ass, asshole. You know, it's like, and you know, there's, you can't treat comedians like the little kid at the Thanksgiving Day table, you know.
Not for long.
Not for long. Right.
I wouldn't recommend doing that for long if you want to make it personal.
Yeah.
You're not going to like it, you know.
Which circles back to your point of the importance of comedy in world events and national events. And you know, it goes back to Will Rogers. And did you ever get to see Mort Saul or work with Mort Saul or any...
Yeah,
or Hicks. Or
yeah, we talk. I mean, whenever I'm up in San Francisco or the Bay Area doing the Mill Valley Throckmorton, he comes by. So we usually meet up every time I'm up there and get a meal or something. Hang out with Robin and Mort.
Oh man,
Robin Williams and Mort.
Oh, Robin's brilliant, and you know.
Yeah, they're neighbors up there.
Oh, they are. Well, Robin also
is
very political in a more subtle way, though. But you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, his improvisation is so brilliant that sometimes it clouded the level of intelligence and pointed point of view of his material, I think. I think he's a brilliant satirist and commentator. And
yeah.
You know, because he's such a brilliant improviser and great actor, not that there's anything wrong with being those things, too. But, you know, I put him in that category of guys like you and Hicks and Mort Saul and who are really strong, necessary voices, you know, in our culture. Really important.
Oh, thank you, man. Wow, that's incredible company. I'm honored, but I think lots of great voices are showing up now that are talking about the human psychology or the human condition or something like that, and they're keeping people alive and awake. It's the arts, and we're in that brightly lit dark age where rock, paper, scissors, the Renaissance always beats the dark age, and we're in the new one, and it looks like this, and maybe we don't know it's a Renaissance. You look back on it and go, oh, that was the Renaissance.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what I love about you is the passion you have, and, like, you're so intelligent, and, like, you're a true artist, because... You know, something to really be admired in that. And are you touring at all? Can people see you anywhere live that you want to let people know about? Obviously, they should go to your podcast overview on the Sideshow Network. You have amazing people. You had Prevenz on. You had this amazing comedian, Paul Mercurio, who I've heard a lot of good things about.
I was going to say again.
But people should go. You got great people on that, and you're really great on it. But if you got anything live happening, you want to plug, let people know about it right now. I want them to come see you live. They can see you in L.A. probably performing there.
The 26th, depending on when this airs, the 26th of this month, we're doing something at Improv Olympic West called News Skim, and that's where set list meets real time. The panel faces out at the audience with a projection screen above them. We put the front page of HuffPo up, the audience, we've moved the cursor around this story, no, this one, then, yeah, that story, we'll turn around, look at the story, and we just take off from there and start going.
Oh, that's so much fun. I would love to see that. This is actually going to air on the 26th, the day that you're doing that, so go check that out.
Great.
And tell them again where they can see that in Los Angeles.
Improv Olympic West in Hollywood, 8 o'clock.
Okay. All right. Sounds good, my man. This is awesome. Thank you, my brother, for doing this, and thank you for being on the podcast.
You.
You're the best.
Oh, you're
brilliant.
You're brilliant. You're a man of incredible integrity, and you've written some magnificent material that is like all-time favorite of mine. You got a great mind and a wonderful heart. That's a good combo, brother. It's an honor to know you, man.
Thanks, man. Tell my wife that so I get some respect in this goddamn house of mine, will you? All right, buddy.
I'm not bad. The cops know better than to get into domestics. No, wait till it's over. I'm not going between it.
All right, man. Have a good day. Thanks for doing this. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Paul. Talk soon, buddy.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all our turf. Yeah!